Our next speaker is Mr. Joseph Sobran, who is an editor of National Review and whose major claim otherwise is that he's a friend of mine.
Joe. Thank you very much. Thanks, Ernest. My friend, the name is Sobran, by the way. Anyway, to begin with a brief digression, I think that if Hitler had won World War II, the prevailing ideologies in America would look different. I think, for instance, that the kind of universalist socialism that Stalin or the communism represents would have been discredited by Stalin. We'd have had all the pictures of the Gulag camps on our coffee tables rather than of Auschwitz. There would be the German Solzhenitsyns who would tell us about Auschwitz, but on the whole, we would have much more vivid impressions of the evils of communism rather than of Nazism. And I think that the weight somehow of ideology, the weight and shape of it, would have been seriously affected by this. I think that there would be much more, I think racism would still be much more respectable in this country than it is, and liberalism much less so. The problem of the ideology of the mass media has interested me for a long time. I notice all the time that the media use, as what Richard Weaver called, uncontested terms, terms like the lessons of Vietnam, the lessons of Watergate, racism, sexism, compassion, and uses these in special senses, too. You know that they're tendentious when you hear them. Social justice, equality, civil liberties. Now, we can all attach our own rational meanings to these terms, but somehow you know when you hear somebody using these as a kind of set that there is a unifying ideology behind them that's probably just awful and liberal. Liberalism, I take to be the sort of watered-down American version of socialism, or as I like to call it, the socialism that dare not speak its name. I see American liberalism as, to a great extent, and especially since the late 60s, an extension of European socialism, which in turn draws a lot of its power from the existence of a great socialist power to its east. The Soviet Union is, of course, an embarrassment to most socialists in this world, and yet, at the same time, I think socialism depends on the Soviet Union, its existence, and so forth, for a good deal of its prestige. It doesn't want to take concrete responsibility for the Soviet Union. Nonetheless, somehow the existence of the Soviet Union validates a good many socialist ideals in what I'll call the higher popular mind. The media are populated by people whom I would describe as acquiescent rather than militant liberals. They are people who would rather not be thought of as ideological in any way, for the most part. In fact, they take professional pride in keeping their opinions separate from their facts. When we see their opinions shaping their facts, I think we're too ready to conclude that they have smuggled their opinions in, when I think the truth of the matter is far more often that they're unconscious that their opinions are opinions. They think that these terms are not only uncontested but incontestable, social justice and so forth, equality and so forth. They don't think of these as representing any kind of controversial value. They think of them almost as givens, something that every decent-minded and educated person should believe in. Now, I also have what I think is a wonderfully invidious metaphor for the socialist world. I think of it as a kind of hive. I've been saying this in print for some time now. Some of you may have already been bored with this metaphor, but for the sake of those of you who haven't been exposed to it, I'll plunge ahead. I compare it to a beehive because there are different kinds of bees in a hive, and nevertheless, they cooperate. Also, no bee in the hive can describe the hive or its purposes, and yet there is a harmony in it. There is a purpose, an overarching purpose. And I think in the same way, the socialist hive, ranging from liberals here to communists in the East, is a unit in some sense. It's a single system. It's suffering great losses now, defections especially here. But even so, it's a reality. Now, socialist presumptions get implanted very early on. There is a kind of bias in segments of our culture in favor of socialism. I'd just like to outline these briefly before I talk about the media specifically. In the public schools, the grade schools all the way up to high school, we have the exclusion of religion. It's systematic. The Supreme Court has insisted on it as a constitutional principle. Most recently in this case the other day in which the court ruled that I think it was Kentucky cannot require the posting of the Ten Commandments in all state schools. Now, that's constitutionally very dubious, it seems to me, reading the Constitution as she was written. The Constitution says Congress shall make no law requiring or respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, of course, under the incorporation doctrine, the 14th Amendment applies, the First Amendment and the other amendments, early amendments, to the states as well as to the federal government, but only in a limited sense. If you recall, it applies the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Nobody's free exercise of religion, nobody's personal right, is violated by a state establishment of religion. There's clearly, I think, a bias in recent Supreme Court decisions, recent meaning for about the last 35 years or so, against religion as such, that the court has used the Constitution and the loose idea of a separation of church and state as an excuse to exclude religion from public education. So we have a public education system which is established, as it were, in the way a church might be established. That is, you have to pay for it whether or not you make use of it, and even if you decide to pay for an alternative too. It enjoys a privileged position, and its weight is thrown against religion in that sense. Now, in the universities, of course, hostility to religion is more overt. There again, I think it's fair to say that if a professor were to teach religion in the state universities, if he were to preach, he would be attacked by the American Civil Liberties Union for using a state institution in support of religion. He'd be accused of violating the First Amendment. If, however, he were to attack religion, he would be practicing academic freedom. The people who populate the media are people who've come through this whole system. Many of them have had no religious education at all. A lot of others who have get the idea that they should be, well, that religion is not discussed in polite society except as a potential menace. What I'm driving at, of course, is simply that there are biases that are absorbed all the way along, that are propagated systematically in American society. The Supreme Court itself has been one of the agents through which a false doctrine, constitutional doctrine, has been promulgated in order to put religious teaching at a great disadvantage in this country. The entertainment industry and the communications industries I see as a kind of extension of a whole larger system of communication, embracing education too. So people who come through this whole system are naturally going to have certain kinds of biases, which we loosely describe as liberal. They're taught to be anti-authoritarian in some ways and not to recognize their own authoritarian biases in others. And yet, as I said before, the people who come through the system are acquiescent liberals or socialists rather than militant ones. They try to shed their prejudices when they do their professional work, most of them, not all. And yet they find it very hard to do so. And you can see them straining to be non-ideological sometimes when they report the news. In fact, I wish they were rather more overtly ideological rather than less so, for reasons I'll now try to explain. Anyone who's ever told a fairy tale to a little girl has probably had an interruption something like this. You start out by saying, "Once upon a time there was a king." And the little girl, before you can say whether he was a constitutional monarch or a debaser of his country's currency, will say something like, "Was he a good king or a bad king?" Well, it's a good question, of course, but it's the one only God can answer. After the fairy tale stage, we usually realize that we can only answer it obliquely with all kinds of qualifications of the sort that madden little girls. What they don't realize is that you can be both a good man and a bad king, or a bad man and a good king, or both a good man and a good king, though for distinct reasons. In presenting the world out there to the American public, the media have increasingly adopted a kind of good king, bad king approach in an attempt to be non-ideological. This approach, of course, is simplistic and leads to a lot of problems. I think, though, that the problems have become aggravated as the media have become more sophisticated. At one time, a good king was simply one who was on our side. Stalin qualified by that criterion. But since the 60s, the media have been increasingly exploiting a paradox they seem to have discovered about that time, namely that a bad king could be on our side. The first such bad king, I think, was President Diem of South Vietnam. I have a hunch that the media attacks on him were largely instigated by President Kennedy, our last good king. But in any case, Vietnam was afflicted right after that with a succession of bad kings, including General Key and President Tu, whose police chief shot in Saigon shot a man on television, an act which couldn't possibly occur under a good king. Many of our allies, alas, have turned out to be bad kings. Ian Smith, Anastasio Somoza, the Shah of Iran. Happily, they're gone now. But there remain, of course, people like Menachem Begin, whom hopefully further exposure in the media will remove. Now, the attitude that shapes media coverage of our allies in this way may seem more critical in a superficial way than the popular attitude that whoever is on our side is, ipso facto, a good king. But, of course, it all depends what we mean by critical. There's this to be said for the popular view. At least it's purposeful. If he's on our side, it says, he may not be perfect, but he's good enough for us. The media attitude, by contrast, seems to be more murky as you try to understand it more. If you're going to divide people simply into good and bad, you should have a clear criterion. A crude division based on a foggy principle isn't really very intelligent. One based on loyalty is. Now, the aggregate effect of TV news coverage is about as corrosive to the intelligence as watching sitcoms every night. In fact, news and entertainment can't be very sharply divided, I think, on television. The news has a way of turning the world into a slightly grim global sitcom in which, as in all sitcoms, the father figures become butts of scorn. I note that ever since the murder of our last good king, we seem to have had nothing but bad kings. The media have done their part to get rid of quite a few bad kings lately, our own leaders, and, of course, as I've said, our allies as well. George Will put it nicely in a parenthesis a few months ago when speaking of our allies, when President Carter was about to ditch another one, he said, "We have so many of them." A fairy tale, of course, has some kind of structure. A bad king isn't a real character so much as a structural premise. But the news, like a serial, has no such order and unity as a fairy tale has. It has an uncomfortable smack of randomness about it. We're always vaguely wondering, why is this news? Why are they showing us this? Sometimes those who show it must be wondering the same thing. Conservatives are always complaining about liberal bias in the media, and those complaints aren't baseless. But they may be wrong-headed. A bias implies an outlook, a kind of focus. All cognition is purposeful. All units take significance from their context. There's no such thing as a fact in the state of nature. It's not a natural phenomenon. I wonder if it wouldn't be better if the news were frankly committed to political values. Not that the news should be propaganda, but that it would be improved, I think, by a clear principle of selection, in the absence of which it tends toward abstract and destructive moralizing. I happen to think the New York Times is flawed by its furtive repertorial liberalism. But I also think it owes much of its greatness to the fact that it has a consistent point of view at all. Despite its suffocating pomposity, lots of people call it the Good Gray Times, I think it should be renamed the New York Daily Weltanschauung. It doesn't give us anything like all the news that's fit to print. But it does take the initiative in gathering news, and its news really is news, at least from its point of view. We can always make a certain allowance for its ideological differences from our views. Within its limits, it's a tremendously useful and even reliable organ. Now, contrast that with TV news. There we find a certain amount of furtive or even overt ideology, but much more often, I'm afraid, a crippling timidity. Foreign policy reduces to a sort of good kings, bad kings sort of thing. The subject of TV coverage is the personal virtues and vices of foreign potentates, so far as those virtues and vices are exposed to the camera. What's most irksome about all this trivialism is that after a half hour of it, an announcer comes on and tells us, "And that's the way it is." I've always found that annoying, but I've only recently come to understand why. It's this. If you have to make, you have to make a careful distinction between being accurate and informative, which TV news can be, and being comprehensive and definitive, which it can never be. The pretense that because it gives us some stories we couldn't ourselves get, and because it offers a sensory immediacy we couldn't otherwise experience, it's therefore giving reality in its wholeness. That's the insidious claim that television should not be permitted to make. The real credo of TV news should not be, "That's the way it is," but, "We have footage of it, therefore it exists." Consider the way whole subcontinents flicker on and off our screens. Almost the entire communist world is off limits to news coverage as we know it. The 60 Minutes crew can't barge in on the Kremlin on a given morning and ruin their day. Ethiopia and Cambodia both were closed to news coverage at about the time the real news began there, the newsworthy events, I should say. But because there are no clear criteria of newsworthiness, the Western media have shirked their duty of reporting these things with the fullness they deserve. Where are the Woodwards and Bernsteins and the Seymour Hirshes to pursue with their celebrated intrepidity the stories locked inside the socialist camp? Why do they respond to the socialist powers' no trespassing notices by going elsewhere for the big story? Why do they tamely submit to the greatest, longest, most extensive, and most systematic cover-up in the history of news? I don't mean to understate the dangers of actually pursuing news in such quarters. But if there really is such a thing as the people's right to know, then it applies to the whole world and not just the more civilized and hospitable parts of it. The media right now should be intensifying their efforts to get stories out of the totalitarian camp. They should be concentrating resources on their own principles, not mine particularly, precisely where they find most resistance to public exposure, just like Watergate. But if they decide, reasonably maybe, that they can't bear the risks and expenses of such an undertaking, then they should say so frankly. They should have the integrity to remind us of the very incompleteness of their news coverage, putting the blame, of course, right where it belongs, on those socialist powers who decide that all news must be subordinate to the interests of the state. At present, though without realizing it, the media and the socialist rulers are partners to a fraud, the fraud that what we see on the evening news is representative of the way it is. Finally, I suggest that we all lower our expectations a bit. The informed citizen is pretty much a myth. If there is such a being, no offense to anyone here, he should be in a zoo. But the news is based on the polite fiction that the average president knows who his congressman is, who his senators are, even perhaps who the vice president is. It's based on the assumption that when Afghanistan pops into the news for 2 weeks, he already knows something about the history, constitution, strategic importance, and even spelling of places like Afghanistan. Worse yet, it's based on the assumption that a half hour of electronic bombardment every evening will make him informed and will serve somehow as a substitute for political philosophy. Maybe we can cut a deal with the mass media. If we quit pretending to be informed citizens, they can quit pretending to inform us. Thank you very much.